Every day may not be good, but there is good in every day. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, October 1st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, that is the philosophy of 2023's National Teacher of the Year. She's a graduate of the University of South Dakota, so what better teacher to join SDPB's Teacher Talk conversation as she visits the state to inspire future educators? We'll talk with Rebecca Peterson about public education as a bedrock of American democracy, because in the public school classroom, everyone has a place at the table. Plus, Ken Burns launches a new documentary on Leonardo da Vinci. So we checked in with one of South Dakota's most innovative and curious artists and inventors. Dick Termas joins us after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new Ken Burns documentary for PBS explores the life and mind of a polymath. Leonardo da Vinci airs on November 18th and 19th on SDPB TV. You can catch a preview of the film this week. First, October 3rd, the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls screens the documentary and hosts activities throughout the evening. I have heard free ice cream is also part of those festivities. And this Saturday, a special event at South Dakota Mines features South Dakota's own Leonardo da Vinci. Dick Termas is a Black Hills artist renowned for the unique three-dimensional way he depicts time and space. His spherical paintings combine art and science in breathtaking ways.
Yeah, I think the math and science maybe came along with the jump because I wanted to capture a complete world. So when I look back upon it anyway, when you're doing it, you don't really realize a lot of times where your mind is taking you. But I actually was interested in getting the whole picture. Instead of a small little canvas on the wall, I took the frame away and let that picture continue up above and around you and underneath you. If you can imagine every painting that you've looked at, can you imagine that as a world? And they've just taken one little piece out of it. That's what I wanted to do and I've been doing. So that's what's really cool about this is that the sphere captures that whole environment, and then this new virtual reality actually puts you inside the sphere, so you really get to see the whole, the north, south, east, west, up and down around you environment. So it's really a neat new step.
When did you start working with virtual reality?
Well, you know, it's actually my niece and nephew are the ones that jumped into that. And then they said, come look at this. This is what your stuff can do. It's work that's growing off of my work, which is very cool, because I've always felt like good artwork should be able to be built uponable, you know?
Yeah.
Like other people can actually jump on the bandwagon and build it into something even more so than what you started with. It actually is a step forward and a step backwards, because when I do the sphere, I imagine I'm painting a complete world on the outside of the sphere. And I keep telling people this, and it's like I have north on one side, south on the other, east, west, up and down. It's always been inside out, you might say, until the virtual reality can put you inside the sphere and see what it actually looks like. Because people look at it and they just start giggling. They say, this is what you've been talking about all these years. And I find that really quite funny.
So when you first put on the virtual reality gear and saw what could happen, was it what you had already been seeing inside your mind?
Right, exactly. Exactly. It is what I was thinking, but it's still quite a treat for me to get inside of them and look at what all of this world looks like, you know, from inside. And that's what we're going to be doing at School of Mines, is having that show tied in with the Da Vinci document, a piece of it, I think, that's going to be going too. And we're going to try and show how my kind of thinking is similar to how Da Vinci thought. I mean, he invented the helicopter before the helicopter. The He was playing around with airplanes before we have airplanes. He was like a surgeon before surgeons did surgery. He knew what was inside the body, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He investigated all that stuff. And then later, something happens that actually creates a real airplane. The Wright brothers come along, you know, and all of that. But he kind of broke the ice in a lot of different directions.
Yeah.
And so it's neat to tie in with him like this.
And people have been building on to so much of what he said for centuries.
Yeah. Oh, my. Yes. And then he was just a great artist, too. I mean, yeah. He did the Mona Lisa. My goodness, you know. I mean, how could you beat that?
I don't know that you can. The innovation, the ability, the willingness, the desire, and the ability to see things that other people haven't seen yet, but also curiosity. What's the role of curiosity in your art career and in your art making?
You know, every piece I do, I can't just do the piece. I have to have learned something from it. When people come into my gallery, they look at so many different directions. That's because I'm actually searching, trying to find something new that the sphere can talk about. I was very lucky to hit on the sphere because it opens your mind to a whole different category of ideas that aren't possible on the flat surface. I'm just driven by trying to figure out, well, what all can you say when you work with a spherical canvas? Because it's a total picture canvas, but it's also all the three-dimensional geometries. So I've gotten into all the geometries that fit on a sphere too, all the platonic solids, because they also help me with ideas. I'm working on a new commission of the Black Hills right now and the Native people, basically the two of those kind of interwoven. And I'm playing with a polyhedron structure that has a 3-4-5 system to it. It's called a rhombic icosadodecahedron. I love that name. It took me a while to be able to say that. A rhombic icosadodecahedron, you know?
Nice.
So I'm trying to figure out how that connects with our Native people and with Black Hills, and how a structure like that can also be a good structure to interweave with the Black Hills and the Native people here. And I'm trying to start it before Custer came along. Hmm. And so it's everything ahead of that. I don't want to get into all the wars and all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be kind of fun. But it's interesting how you can try and tie mathematics and geometry in with a concept like that. And it, by doing that, it actually gives me back lots of new, fresh ideas by forcing myself to fit these two things together.
Yeah, I think that is just so a masterclass for every artist, no matter what field you're in, really everybody, but in the arts, like if you're not learning something from the piece that you're doing, maybe you should be doing a different piece. Like what is the next thing that you can learn? On this show, I learn so much. It's not just a conversation, it's a learning opportunity for everyone who's in conversation with us right now. And right. I just love that. I think that's so challenging and inspiring and delightful. It makes being alive just really great, doesn't it?
It really does. Yes, it does. It makes it a lot more fun. I can't believe people that can stick with the same thing day after day after day. I just am not that type of person. I just have to try and explore new things and hit on new ideas. That I've got a few ideas that I keep going, why aren't people excited about this? A certain, you know, some of these things I'm bringing to the show along the side are other invention kind of ideas that I want people to play with and see if they get excited about it, because they excite me a lot. Yeah. I just want to see how it touches other people.
Is there anything from your childhood that you think, this is when I remember that spark of curiosity being lit?
It's a good question. I'm not sure if I can, you know, I'm sure it was always there, and I've always been curious about lots of stuff. I think it took me a while to realize that I wanted to end up in the arts.
Yeah.
The arts, the advantage of the arts is that it opens the door, and there isn't like a rules that go with the arts. you create your own rules as you go along. And if they're sort of right, people say, oh, yeah, that's good. And that's in the arts, you know. But if you're in science and math, you've got to do stuff that fits with what's already been done. In the arts, you're allowed to play with math, play with science, and not follow their rules. And then sometimes by just playing with it, you come up with stuff they wouldn't have thought of. It's interesting because it just when you have a free mind to think about stuff, it's a lot different than when you have to follow 18 books ahead of you and you have to do the next chapter. And you kind of go, I don't want to read these 18 books. I just want to do the new chapter. Then that's what the arts are good for. They're really fun that way, that you can really play with your mind. I've often thought that's what my job has been, is just being able to play with my mind my whole life. And it's just what an honor it is to not have a lot of the other worries that people have. I've been lucky because I've been able to make enough of a living to be able to have a free life, to be able to think what I wanted to think about. What a super life that is when you get to do that.
And how lucky the rest of us are to get to be part of it, because you invite other people in to that. We're in the art gallery with the virtual reality goggles on, seeing a hint at what you see. We're in the space with you. You teach art. You bring other people along to all that innovation. You spend a lot of time giving us that in return, and we're grateful for that.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm glad you said that. That's very nice. I appreciate it.
How much time a day do you just spend thinking or tinkering?
Well, my thinking is, I find I think better as I'm drawing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't just think. I have to have an idea and be playing with it in drawing form. And it seems like the drawing and the painting actually help me come up with the ideas. When I'm just thinking about how am I going to like this piece, I've been thinking and thinking about how can I do a piece of the Black Hills that's different than anything I've done, that plays with the Native people, that's different than anything I've done. And then until I actually start putting it down and start playing with it, then all of a sudden I go, oh, yeah, this is what I should do. Yeah. This is how these can fit. So the ideas really come from the working the media along, you know, keeping that going.
So you have to trust that process and just enjoy it and let it unfold.
Right. Yes, yeah. Indeed. Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. All right. This event coming up, anything that you want to say about Saturday, October 5th at South Dakota Mines?
It should be really fun. I think people will really get a kick out of it. I hope they'll come by and put their Oculuses that they put on. We're going to have three different chairs and three different Oculus, so you get to see a different sphere on each one. The spheres will be there to look at and see the outside of them, and then all of a sudden you can go poop and you're on the inside of them. One kid out in California that I showed this to, when he looked for, he was on it for like 2.5 hours, I think. And when he came out of it, he stared at me and he says, you just put me in your dreams. And I thought, whoa, that's an interesting way. It's a dream world. We are this paint anyway. It's like our kind of a mysterious dream world that we create. And he recognized that I forced him to be in my world for a while and live. Like, can you imagine being inside a complete environment of Van Gogh? You know, he didn't ever do it on a sphere, but it would be a wonderful wild world that you would get to live inside of.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be doing a kind of a workshop along with it, where we play with magnetic sticks and balls, and we're going to build all kinds of polyhedron. So that's going to be going on while people are waiting to look at the virtual. And then a short document of Da Vinci, Leonardo, will be going some pieces. This will all be happening from 1 to 4:30.
Okay.
And then I'm going to give a little lecture at 4 o'clock and show videos of a lot of my work and some of my thinking, some other pieces, you know. So, and then I'm going to have these 3D puzzles that are actually spheres that have been flattened out into polyhedron. And then the pieces are laying there, and you stick them together on a magnetic board, a steel board, that they're magnetic, And then you try and build your own thermosphere, kind of. And it's tetrahedrons, octahedrons, dodecahedrons, all of these different shapes. And then I've got one that's a really good one for really smart middle school kids. Love it because there's seven Earths that you have to put together in this polyhedron. And the seven Earths have to fit perfect together. The continents have to be lined up like they should. But there's seven of them. And what I learned was when you take a tetrahedron, which is four equilateral triangles, and you flatten the Earth into that, and then you open it up and lay it out flat, it tessellates, it repeats itself. If you get another set of four, they'll fit right with the first four, and it goes to infinity in all directions. So it'll do that in a three-dimensional polyhedron too. And that's what you have to put these pieces together to get seven continents to read accurately.
Wow.
And it's a challenge. It's a fun challenge for anybody that comes along.
You have blown my mind.
So we're hoping middle school all the way through senior citizens will join us for this.
This world that we live in. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it's fun. And this will be fun. The School of Minds is a perfect place because a lot of those minds that are at the mines are perfect to get into this kind of stuff, I think.
Yeah, I love that. This has just made me look at the universe in a new way today and want to go some art and play. Echoes of Innovation, a virtual reality leap from Da Vinci to Termas, is this Saturday, October 5th, at the School of Mines. You'll get to enjoy all of the fun activities that Termas just described, kicking off at 1 p.m. local time. Learn more online at sdpb.ticketbud.com. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. University of South Dakota graduate Rebecca Peterson was the 2023 National Teacher of the Year. She visited South Dakota to address the next generation of teachers at USD's Educators Rising Day. Now, Peterson is a math teacher who loves stories. She believes when we learn another person's stories, we carry a piece of each other with us. Her home school, since 2012, is Union High School in Tulsa, Oklahoma. With that said, SDPB's Teacher Talk was able to welcome our second special guest. Rebecca Peterson joined Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
As Oklahoma Teacher of the Year, but really like my teaching journey started and was like my passion for teaching really was ignited in South Dakota. I had no real intention of becoming a teacher. I am an immigrant to the United States. I'm the daughter of medical missionaries. So by the time I was 16, I'd lived in a whole lot of countries. I'd lived in four countries. And I'd never even gone to a real American high school. So teaching at the high school level was so far off my radar, right? Because how do you teach something you haven't experienced yourself? But I met this really cool guy named Brett Peterson in undergrad in Oklahoma, and he was this, South Dakotan accounting major, and we graduated from undergrad in Oklahoma, and I kind of followed him to USD for graduate school because we were young and not very wealthy, and in-state tuition was very appealing. Then the school offered me a teaching assistantship and offered me like a pathway into their mathematics graduate program for their master's degree. Mm-hmm. And they're just the most wonderful people, like truly. And I have such a love for math, I think, largely because of moving so much and moving from country to country, like, you know, the language changed, the culture would change, the food would change, the climate would change, the expectations would change, but like numbers were this constant for me, there's this universality to numbers and mathematics. So I don't know, I just really clicked with the math department at USD, and then I got to teach as well. And I remember having this thought of, like, I'm really looking forward to going to my math classes, right, and learning, but I'm actually looking forward to going to the classes I was teaching even more.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, something just really ignited in me, and that I have USD to thank for that. And I guess the rest is kind of history. Then I decided, maybe I do want to give this teaching thing a try.
So you mentioned high school and teaching in a place where you never spent time in an American high school as an American high school student, and now you're in the classroom and you have a rough time getting started.
Yeah, yeah.
To the point where you're thinking, maybe I cannot do this. Mm-hmm. What did you turn to then that helped you figure out how to make this career work? Because it wasn't just I'm a fish in water now and I feel great experience.
Oh, no, it was not at all. I taught for 2 years at USD, and then I taught another year at a community college in Oklahoma, and then, yes, very adorably thought, oh, I can teach high schoolers. it was so difficult, and I think it almost made it harder for me because I thought I knew what I was doing, because the college kids loved me, you know, and I got rave reviews, and then I jumped into this high school classroom and I was like, why are they always on their phones and no one's paying attention to me? I thought I was so good at delivering mathematics, and it turns out that's not enough, frankly. Two things that saved me. One was my colleagues. This job is just too hard to do alone. So I had colleagues that really took me under their wings and, affirmed that it was difficult work, but also affirmed that it was work I could do. And then the other thing that I really think saved my career was this blog called One Good Thing. And it was a collective of math teachers, actually, at the time, all over the country, who were committed to writing good things that happened in their classrooms. And they lived by this mantra that every day may not be good, but there's something good in every day. And that quote just hit me so viscerally, because it didn't ignore the demands of my job, but did insist on taking ownership of my day. So I just started writing something good every day.
Good every day. Okay.
You know what I mean? Yeah. These small, really small moments, and moments that happen in most classrooms all over this country. But they were moments that I was missing because I wasn't making space for them to land.
Jackie Wilbur, I wanted to reflect back on what Rebecca said when it comes to relying on your colleagues and the idea that you can learn how to do this thing better. You don't have to cut the growth mindset that you're always talking about. You don't have to come in the classroom and be a natural,
right?
In quotation marks. This is work, and it's a learned skill, and you can learn some of these things. What does that bring up for you?
Well, I think it's just such a powerful example for people going into the profession to hear your story and to say, it was hard, and I wasn't sure. Yeah. And now I'm National Teacher of the Year. Yeah. I think that's genuinely what it's all about. That story is so inspiring. And I have to tell you, I've been showing your picture and advertising that you're coming. And so I'm like, look, we're award-winning teachers. She's one. Yeah. We're one. Yeah. And I'm doing this kind of thing in my classroom at USD. And students are really inspired to hear your story. It is powerful to know that you've done what you've done. And so I think just knowing... sharing the part of where you were is also the piece, because I do think that we think that we just come out the gate ready to go.
Yeah,
no problems.
100%.
And for people who have been to high school, maybe you wouldn't have. I wonder if that didn't help you, the fact that you're like, well, I've never been in this environment. But if you've been in this environment, you might think, well, why don't I know how to do this? You at least had this opportunity to say, I haven't. You know, there was a humility.
Yes.
That you brought to the front of the classroom.
I remember the first day they were lining up at the door, and I was like, what is going on? what are you doing? Class is not, nobody's dismissed you.
All those things. So think about being an immigrant student and having that same thought of, why are they all doing this right now?
Yeah, 100%.
Why are they all doing this? Gina, relying on your colleagues, that is so, so important. When you see a new colleague come into the school and you know they need a little help, does that make you, I don't want to say excited, like, ooh, someone's struggling. Put on your cape and go fly into the classroom to help. But do you feel like you have at your high school a system in place, a community in place where you're like, yes, come on in. We've got your back.
Well, we do have a structure that's called instructional coaches. So in the district, we have people who are considered experts, excellent teachers in high school math, in music, in third grade. And they support the new teachers especially, but they're there to support all teachers, to coach us, to help us through sticky situations. So we have that system. But the math instructional coach for the whole district has four high schools, right?
Sure.
For our district. And so that person can't be present at all times. And that's where the school community steps in. So across the hall from me right now is not a new teacher. He's taught for 17 years, but he's new to our school. And so my next door neighbor at school and I, we take him under our wing. And you have to also just feel the waters. How much do they want for support?
Sure.
What kind of support? You can't go in just ready to bombard them with everything.
No capes involved,
No capes. No, you read the room.
I want to pull this up for a minute because it's the National Teacher of the Year application, because I want people to understand what we consider the Teacher of the Year is. It's not just that you're really cool and your students love you. This is quantitative.
Yeah.
You are seeing results in passing the AP test, in graduating students, and some of these results are shocking in their success rate. You tried to get there. Quantify success in your classroom to the point where you can tell people on a national level, this is what's possible when I did these things.
I do think that's where my math background really did shine, because in my DNA, I suppose, of just like, how do I know it's working? To me, once I started teaching AP calculus, I was like, well, that feels pretty quantifiable, feels fairly unbiased, right? Like, it's not an assessment I made up, nor even my district or state. Like, this is a national assessment. And so my first year teaching AP calculus, I had exactly a 50% pass rate. And I just thought, like, kids spent a whole year, you know, learning this content. Half of them did not garner college credit, which was kind of a gut check for me. And I, you know, master's in math, I had taught calculus at the college level. And then I started like looping from pre-calc to calculus. And then I started kind of distilling and like disaggregating that data and noticing that the kids who were looping with me from pre-calc to calc had 100% pass rate, and those who were not had about a 75% pass rate. So like, we were doing better, but then that felt really inequitable because that's just luck of the draw, right? And I also knew it was not because I was this great pre-calc teacher, because our program was so streamlined in the high school that kids got a very similar experience in pre-calc, no matter what teacher they had. I knew, like, it was those kids who lived with me felt comfortable with me and trusted me and, like, felt safe to ask questions and make mistakes and try again. And so that was another, like, kind of gut check of how do I make up for a year, you know? And then I was told I would not be teaching pre-calc anymore, and was like, oh, well, that's going to hurt our pass rate. And so I thought, okay, I really have to figure out how we
make
up. What
made you think it was the relationship? What made you think that, was it because there was such a similarity in the, you know, what they would have learned in your classroom versus someone else?
Yes, exactly. Because
And again, that humility where you're like it's not just that I'm some amazing rock star.
And I could tell their knowledge coming in was so similar, their math knowledge, right? But I also could feel that there is a difference between the kids who had had me for a year before and like how willing they were to take risks and like really try, right?
God, that's huge, isn't it?
Huge.
Yeah.
So you needed to get to know them and figure out a way. I love this. Another math teacher waved. How can I quantify my relationship?
I know. I'm like listening to myself talking. Like, oof. So I did something quite unconventional, I think. And I learned this actually from one of my undergrad professors. And the first year of school, I shared my story and the joys and like struggles of being an immigrant. And I teach in a really now diverse district, but it has historically been, I mean, 20 years ago, it was very affluent. Now we're 80% free and reduced lunch. We have 62 languages represented. And at the district level, they had worked really hard to make sure that like our AP classes looked like our hallways, right? And so so I'm teaching at this very like diverse school, and now seeing also like I'm gonna lose the key. I'm not gonna be looping anymore. Mm-hmm. So I just shared my story the first day of school, and then like I remember like my hands sweaty and shaking and saying like, really like to learn your story. And I passed this like sign up sheet with time slots throughout the upcoming weeks where they could come and tell me their story before school, after school, during lunch. And it was so powerful to know them first and foremost as human beings before even like diving in to the mathematics. And I say like there's just this like, I've done it for several years now, like this atmospheric shift in the classroom where like I just felt really different, and I think they did too. And I could sense throughout that year like they were asking more questions and like willing to take more risk. And lo and behold, like we reduced that that gap from 25 percentage points to 8 percentage points.
Wow.
And now they have an 89% pass rate as a whole on the AP exam in comparison to the rest of the state, which is at about a 45% pass rate.
That's amazing.
You know, kids who statistically should not be outperforming their more affluent peers. But as teachers, like, we refuse to let our kids be a statistic.
What did they show up and tell you? Like, they talk for a long time, a short time, when you just left it open and said, you know, come tell me a story. Mm-hmm. How did they interpret that?
So now I'll have kids come. Well, I say now, I've had a couple of years of service, been out of the classroom, but most recently kids will come and say like, you know, I knew about you because of a sibling or whatever, and I've been waiting 4 years to tell you my story.
Wow.
And it's just like, whoa. I'm like giving, I mean, it is a 15 minute time slot. No. You know, high schoolers will like stretch that sometimes if they need to. My mentor says it best, like kids spell love T-I-M-E, you know, and like what happens when we give them our really one of our most valuable non-renewable resources, you know, they just something really magical happens, I think. And they'll talk about like their family, their sports, their after school commitments or clubs or activities, what they want to do post graduation. And then sometimes, you know, they'll say like, I, you know, my grandpa passed away this summer and I'm struggling, or my friends group is shifting and I'm struggling, or I was, you know, on track to go to college for soccer and now I have an injury that's going to put me out my entire senior season. You know, like Glennon Doyle says it so well, it's like beautiful moments and brutal moments. They're like brutal, which is like just the crux of doing really human work.
Yeah. Gina, some of this happens in the classroom around the discussion about a book. You will hear stories as well. What's the value for you as an educator when you know a sliver of a personal story is shimmering through?
As I was listening to Rebecca talk, I thought what she was creating was trust, safety, and belonging in the classroom. And if you have me take AP calculus or any math class, that's a very vulnerable position for a lot of people to be in.
Yes.
Yeah.
To create that safety, that trust, that belonging makes them feel probably okay to make mistakes and you'll still like them.
Yeah.
You'll still work with them. That's vital. And it's vital in my English classroom, too, especially because writing is a really vulnerable activity, too.
Yeah.
How often do you hand other people your writing?
Correct.
And if you do, you're very careful who you hand it to. Yeah. So creating, I would like to call it fertile soil.
Mm.
And the fertile soil is made up of trust, belonging, safety. And when I say safety, yes, physical safety, more so emotional safety.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jackie, what comes to mind when you think about your students, college students, and their students that they will eventually teach, sharing the beautiful, just, hey, tell me a little bit of your human story. Mm-hmm. That lasts forever. That endures.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think about a lot of things. I think about how necessary it is that you start with you telling your story first.
Yeah.
And that you know what that is and you are able to, I'm assuming, tell it to them in a way that is vulnerable but has boundaries and is an adult being a safe person telling a human story that they can relate to, but also in
still
this
being
like
professional.
Yeah, in this package of being their high school teacher. Mm-hmm. First of all, what an example to be able to set of this is how you can communicate about your feelings and about who you are without kind of crying or bleeding all over the way I was tending to do when I was in high school myself. Yeah. So I think that that part is such a key piece. And so I'm thinking about that for my own college students now of get that part down, right? Like get that part down where you can talk about your own story in a way that is in that zone of being their teacher.
Yeah. What are the ways that teachers can practice their own story and say, these are the kinds of things that model what I'm getting at, that open a door, but that are authentic, that because we all have struggles.
Yeah.
And that for some teachers who are like, wow, I don't have any. I had a great family and I grew up great. And then I went into teaching and I love to teach. That might not open the door wide enough for somebody to tell their story if it's vastly different from the teacher in the front of the room. So how did you do that, knowing that you had to create, you know, a connection through the telling of your own story?
It took me a long time because I think, like, I don't know, for me at least, I don't think I quite knew myself when I first started teaching, or not certainly not to the depth I do now. I mean, like, here I was, this immigrant, teaching in a district full of immigrants, but being like, well, I didn't go to an American high school, so, like, I can't relate. I'm like, but all humans can relate. Like, you can find commonalities with everyone, even if your experiences are different. Those emotions are human and are the same. So, yes, I did practice some, and I went through, like, really, what do I want to talk about? And so for me, it was, like, talking about, like, yes, we moved a lot, and also, like, we're going to look at a map. We'll do this tomorrow. Really, like, see where these countries are. Because, yes, that can be really, like, affirming and welcoming to my students who come from similar regions. Also so important for my students who were born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to see. So I think part of it is, like, factual and, like, autobiographical, right? But then, like, leaving a little bit, getting into, like, some of those hardship, but leaving, like, a little bit perhaps up to interpretation, but making those connections, right? Of, like, I know what it's like to feel judged because your parents have an accent, right? I know what it's like to not quite understand the holidays, or I still, like, mess up words and, like, my colleagues laugh at me, right? Like, I know what it's like to feel like you're in one culture in school and another culture at home, but ultimately, what I know it feels like is to be an outsider, right? And that, everyone knows what that feels like. So I think it's finding, like, the pieces of your story that lead to that place of connection.
Everyone knows what it's like to feel like an outsider. I love that.
Yeah.
You write so just, I want to clap my hands or pound the table. As you talk about in an American public school, everyone has a spot at the table, and that is what democracy looks like.
Right. That's right.
Talk about that just because I want to hear you say it.
This will get me fired up. No, this is, like, really what it is about for me. And I, again, it didn't, interestingly, like, dawn on me right away. But this, to me, is what my teaching philosophy is now, like, based on, right? Like, everybody's in. I know what it's like to not feel like you're in. And so in my classroom, like, everyone's in. Everyone has a seat at the table. You're in on your good days, your bad days, whether you are in the A or not, right? And this is the heartbeat of teachers, like, and that's central to our country, right? Like, everyone's in, everyone belongs, no matter the color of their skin, zip code, gender, no matter their socioeconomic standing, religious affiliation, immigration status, sexual orientation. Like, our differences make us beautiful. All are welcome. All have a seat at the table. All voices get equal representation is what we say in this country, right? And that's the heartbeat of public education. We, as teachers, safeguard that, right? We safeguard that idea that every voice matters.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation with Rebecca Peterson. She's the 2023 National Teacher of the Year. Joining us for the conversation, SDPB Teacher Talk co-hosts Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur. For people across South Dakota, because you've driven all over Oklahoma and sat with teachers in rural communities across the state of Oklahoma, there's some similarities to South Dakota.
Definitely.
How can communities take responsibility or take ownership for teacher morale?
We need to get the public back in public education. If you are a parent, guardian, aunt, uncle, grandparent, please, 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 I'm begging you, go volunteer in schools. Go see what's really happening, because there's a lot of people who have a lot of opinions about schools, and I have issues with that, because I think as teachers, we're the ones in the classroom, and we're the ones who should be, like, changing that narrative. I would ask you to go spend time in a school and go really help and be of service in any way you can. Like, if that is volunteering once a week, if it is, you know, just committing to one teacher and, like, supporting that person, like, every week, every month, sending them a text of encouragement, reminding them their work matters, like, shoot them a Starbucks gift card or an Amazon gift card. Maybe it is, like, setting an alarm on your watch every day, and, like, if you're a person of faith, like, praying for them, or not, if you just, like, hold them in your heart for a bit, like, create that space for teachers, because the thing is, like, teachers hold story after story, year after year. And I'm asking the public to please hold teacher stories as well, because the only way we win and the only way kids win is if we lock arms, carry each other's stories, and, like, do this work together. So I ask that the public please get into public schools and serve and work alongside teachers. I think that would change things.
You know, when you drive by the school and you have to slow down for the speed limit,
that's right. That's your mindful moment.
That's your mindful moment. You're slowing down to 20 miles an hour, and that you have a chance
hold,
to
hold
let
those kids, hold those teachers in your heart.
Great idea.
Really great.
What questions do you have for Rebecca?
I would like to ask one on behalf of one of my students.
Yeah.
So they wanted to know, like, what's the road to becoming the National Teacher
of
the Year?
Oh, okay.
Like, what are the steps? How did it happen?
So every state is a little bit different. So I will tell you my journey. So in Oklahoma, you're, like, building Teacher of the Year first. And I'm going to be very intentional about the verbs I use. So I won for my building. Okay. Then my colleagues chose me, but it was like a, here you go. And actually there are three building teachers of the year, because I teach in a building with almost 200 certified staff and 3,500 kids. So I joke, that was the first year we had three. I said, if we would have always just had one, I never would have made it past my building teacher of the year. So I won that, and then I was selected as my district teacher of the year. So that was portfolio and interview. So I was building teacher of the year fall 2021. Anyway, that next spring, I was our district teacher of the year. And then that summer, then you work on your state portfolio. So that summer was another portfolio written process. And then that fall, I was selected as one of 12 finalists for the state. I remember going to this meeting, and they were talking about, like, what happens if you're selected as state teacher of the year. And I remember being like, I don't know why we're having this conversation. Like, I'm not going to be selected, and I'm really hungry and just wish they had lunch for us. And then we went through an interview process, and then it was like surprise announcement in front of, like, this kind of like gala type thing. Like, if you like Google the photo of me from that day, I mean, my face says it all. Like, it's just complete. Like, what just happened? So then you start your state teacher tenure. Part of that is then one more portfolio. Mm-hmm. So we're now at three portfolios. And then that winter, I got a call saying that I was one of five finalists. And I remember, like, very vividly, she was like, don't say yes yet, because let me tell you what it entails. It was quite a bit different than the state teacher of the year tenure, because you'd be traveling, like, pretty much every week, and not in-state anymore, like, around the country. Mm-hmm. So I had a really serious conversation with my husband and said, like, is this something we even want to, like, pursue? Because this is, like, no, it's not about just me anymore. Mm-hmm. Brett, I'm going to get emotional. He was like, this is about you, and this is about teachers. And if it's your turn to serve, then how do you feel about me just, like, pausing my career and supporting you so you feel like you have the bandwidth to just say yes to everything and throw your whole heart and soul into it, and you also don't have to worry about, at the time, our 7-year-old at home. And he said, okay, like, well, I think we can do this. And so they flew the five of us to D.C. This would have been spring of 2023. And we did a whole day of interviews. So you do a keynote presentation, you field some media questions, you have more like regular interview type questions. And then you fly home, and then two days later I got this call. And I appreciated that it was not a surprise call in front of in a gala or whatever, that I had like time to process. But she told me the same thing. It's Sarah Brown Wessling, who's the 2010 National Teacher of the Year. She's very close, from Iowa, Des Moines. And she runs the National Teacher of the Year program now. Just a huge, I mean, just an incredible teacher and mentor of mine. But she said, again, don't say yes right away, because this is like what it entails. Brett and I had another like serious conversation, and he ended up like taking a sabbatical from his job. And he's a CPA, like, highly educated, highly beloved coworker, and just put his whole professional life on hold, right? So we were able to, like, navigate that year together. And, there was a week where I was in four states in 4 days, none of which were drivable. You know, I mean, it's just constant packing and unpacking and trying to remember, like, which group I'm with and what I'm about to say. And he was just there for me every step of the way. And there is no way I could have come out of that year having grown as much as I did without him walking right alongside me. And so, like I say, from the outside, it looks like it's a story about a teacher, but the truth is it was a love story the whole time.
Teacher Talk is also a podcast. You can find it on your preferred podcasting platform. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. On tomorrow's In the Moment, candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives make their case for your vote. We have Dusty Johnson and Cheryl Johnson outlining their platforms. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.